The blessings of love and respect we offer to all, in times past and present, who have opened the doors of wisdom, reuniting all beings with their intrinsic purity. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. The recitation of this rosary ever expands the awakening of faith in the three jewels, Bodhi, Dharma, and Sangha. Bodhi, Saranam, Gacchami, Dutyampi, Tatyampi, Sabaha. I turn to the perfect nature of truth for guidance. Again and yet again may it be so. Dharmam, Saranam, Gacchami, Dutyampi, Tatyampi, Sabaha. I turn to the teachings for guidance. Again and yet again may it be so. Sangam Saranam Gacchami, Dutyampi Tatyampi Sabaha. I turn to the holy order for guidance. Again and yet again may it be so. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. Dukkha, the noble truth of suffering. Dukkha Samudaya, the noble truth of the origin of suffering. Dukkha Nirodha, the noble truth of the extinction of suffering. Dukkha Nirodha Gamini Patipada, the noble truth of the path that leads to the extinction of suffering. So long as these four noble truths are not understood, we shall wander in sorrow and ignorance. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. All formations are transient. Anicca. All formations are subject to suffering. Dukkha. All things are without a self. Anatta. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. Namo Prajna Paramita Hridaya, homage to the wisdom in the heart.
Form
is not different from emptiness. Emptiness is not different from form. This is the teaching of our spiritual ancestors, Gautama Buddha, and all the great teachers who have transmitted the Dharma to this holy day. Blessed is the knowledge of emptiness. Homage to the devotees of this and all paths of self-purification. May all find simplicity, the joyous and practical guide. The Dharma, being the contents of enlightenment, in which there is no bondage and no suffering, offers freedom from the cankers of ignorance and fear. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. Sangha is the holy order of spiritual ancestors, monks, priests, and all those who follow and practice this path. Homage to the Sangha, homage to all who are approaching this holy path, homage to all who follow and establish this holy path. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. By compassionate comprehension that dissipates delusion, by compassionate aspiration that harms no one, by compassionate speech that makes for clarity, by compassionate self-discipline that brings no regret, by compassionate livelihood that brings no discredit, by compassionate endeavor that results in goodness, by compassionate mindfulness that proves this path, by compassionate awareness that leads to nirvana. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. With this recitation, I do confirm my acceptance of these three pure precepts: the precept of restraint and religious observances, the precept of obedience to all good laws, the precept to benefit all sentient beings.
In this way, I do most deeply
vow to train myself. With this recitation, I do confirm
my acceptance of
these 10 grave prohibitive precepts, not to lead a harmful life, nor to encourage others to do so, not to take that which is not given, not to commit or participate in unchaste conduct, not to tell lies nor practice believing the fantasies of authority, not to use intoxicating drinks or narcotics, nor assist others to do so, not to publish other people's faults, not to extol oneself and slander others, not to be avaricious in bestowal of the teachings, not to be angry, not to speak ill of this religion or any other. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. In the practice of loving kindness, in the practice of pure attention, in the practice of ever expanding faith, in the practice of constant devotion, in the practice of inquiry through correct dhyana, in this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. O happy blessed day, O happy blessed place, O happy blessed time, O happy blessed path, O happy blessed opportunity. In this way, I do most deeply vow to train myself. Here, in humble submission, in order to experience this most perfect now, I deeply bow and sacrifice all thoughts, all tensions, all pressures, and desires. I am born of karma. I am heir to karma. I abide in karma, and I am supported by karma. Whatever I do creates karma, and I shall surely experience this karma. The merit for all good acts I do freely offer to all beings. Dutiampi tatiampi sabaha. Again and yet again may it be so. Willingness is the name of the key to the gate of awakening. For even to awaken from deep sleep and face the new day, there must be the willingness to do it. Here in my hand is the opportunity, and the way is clear beyond the gate of thought and desire. There is no self and other, as the awareness of pure, undisturbed consciousness slips into all consciousness. we are here to end suffering. If ending suffering is more important than anything, we will end suffering. If ending suffering is not more important than anything, we will not end suffering. If I am suffering, it is because I am choosing something over ending suffering. We are not here to create and cling to beliefs. We are here to pay attention. We are here to use everything in our experience to see how we cause ourselves to suffer, so we can drop that and end suffering.
Since we're kind of a small group this morning, if people can move up close, that would be great. What would you like to look at? Linda.
So I've been looking at the process of why.
Why?
Yeah. You know, in Landmark, they like to say that human beings are meaning-making machines. And I watch as the question why is actually an attempt to make meaning.
The question why is an attempt to make meaning.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, there's a long-standing understanding in practice that if you ask a why question, the guide is likely to take you and throw you up against the wall. And whenever I looked at it, what occurred to me was that was because you were seeing something wrong. The only reason for a why question is it implies something's wrong with the way something's being done.
So you saw that a why question implies something's wrong with the way it's being done.
Yeah, why do we do it that way? Kind of implies that there's another way that it should be done.
Which is why the guide would want to throw you up against the wall.
And this morning, as I was watching a process of why, I realized that it was in search of meaning. That something's happening and that shouldn't be, so it's still back to something's wrong. But in exploring, now why is it that, I realized that that was trying to get a fix on some meaning.
So the why questioning was trying to get a fix on some meaning.
Yeah. As if there is some meaning to be gotten. And I didn't look, as I am right this minute, at so then what?
So then what if you get some meaning? Or
Yeah. I think essentially it's probably that then I feel good because I think I know something. Mm-hmm. But there really isn't any use for it. I don't know. It's just really interesting to look at.
It is interesting to look at that. That why.
Yeah. So I'm looking at, and it may be obvious. I'm looking at how does it happen that there are so few of us, and how blessed we are that there are these folks who are here, fewer than there have been in a long, long time. And part of that, of course, is when I just watch what I'm trying to do, I go right back into why. So it was fun to watch that, and not in watching that, I realize I disidentified from anybody who really needed to know anything.
So in watching and being able to step back and watching that whole why process mm-hmm. going on, you noticed that you were able to really disidentify from that person needing to know.
Yeah. In looking at the process, I got to step out of the content, uh-huh. and the content became essentially irrelevant.
Huh. So you saw a process going on, and the content became irrelevant.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see if it stays irrelevant, because I can watch that little loop trying to get me back into answering the why question as if there were an answer. That would stop the questioning somehow, instead of just coming and looking at the process. And, boy, isn't it interesting? And where is how in that?
And where is how in the why questioning?
Or in that process, yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure about that. That may just be another circle back into this, trying to get meaning. Mm-hmm. So it's just really fun to be looking at it in this way.
Fun to be looking at it this morning.
Well, I had a little breakthrough in my golf game.
A breakthrough.
Yeah. The golfer shows up this time of year with a vengeance. And I've been playing for 45 years, and I just had my breakthrough here. I was practicing, which is rolling the ball, just in case someone doesn't know what that means.
So you were putting?
Putting, which is practicing. And I wasn't very present to it. You know, it was just, my mind was all over the place. You know, and I was being told that if you need to do something different after 45 years, what in the heck? And so it just, I guess, all the working with the mentor, what I heard was you're practicing presence. Because it is so clear that when I'm playing golf, I'm really focused and very disidentified. There are almost always insecure voices in the head, in my head, and when that doesn't mean anything, when they don't take me anywhere. When the sensations that have triggered them have nothing attached to them, there's just presence. There's just get up the ball, and the voice says something negative, and I say, "Well, yeah, I usually miss it when I believe that one." And just breathe, and just get right back into exactly where I am, doing exactly what I'm doing. And all I want to do now is practice petting.
So the breakthrough you had this morning was just really seeing that.
Actually, it was a couple of days ago.
A couple of days ago, recently.
Yeah. The breakthrough was simply, I'm not practicing petting. I've always thought I was practicing petting. I'm practicing presence.
The breakthrough is seeing that you're practicing presence.
Yeah.
And, you know, all this time
dropping it,
coming back.
Being present when the garbage arises, dropping it, attaching nothing to it, not pushing it away, just dropping it, just coming back. So, I think I'm going to set myself up as a petting guru. and make a lot of money for that beautiful little children.
So
maybe not, but.
So it's something you acknowledge the mentor's role in this morning, of just really helping you to see that, you know, you are practicing presence, not putting.
Yeah.
And that it's that opportunity to just watch all those voices that want to come in about the golf game and, you know, insecurity, and they're just always there.
Yeah.
And that this is just an opportunity to drop them, come back to the present. And who knows where that will lead in your golf game.
Yeah, and maybe other places.
And other places maybe. Too. Right? Thank you.
So my best year yet, my new paradigm thing is kind of giving everything I have.
Giving everything you have.
Mm-hmm. And it's really helping me to see that there's a story that I believe about this distinction, where if somebody asks me something, I just go. Just empty the contents of my head. And without ever thinking about it or trying to, you know, be really concerned about structuring it, or, you know, it's just like all of a sudden that's what's going on, just volumes of information come out. But if I volunteer anything, it has to be perfect.
Hmm.
So if somebody hasn't asked me, if I'm just going to put something out, the story is it has to be perfectly structured so that you know, it's like this has to be the most compelling thing ever. Whoever encounters this must agree with me, because if they don't, then they might think something bad about me. I don't know what actually the consequence is. The story doesn't get that far.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, if something arises spontaneously, like someone asks you something, There's no problem with giving it your all. You just will empty the contents of your mind. But if it's something that you consciously volunteer to do, then this whole mm-hmm. story gets created around it about how it has to be just absolutely perfect, because it somehow reflects you as a person, what you can bring to this thing that you have volunteered to do.
Yeah, it's sort of like, if I'm going to intrude on other people's lives with some information, then it has to, you know, I have to have all my ducks in a row or whatever. I don't know what that means either. I keep finding all these metaphors. I don't know what they mean. Which is a fascinating process in and of itself. Why is my brain grasping at these vague lumps instead of just finding the words? But, you know, I have to have everything just perfect. And it's really funny because I know there's the awareness that the other process, where it's just spontaneously whatever comes through, is where all of the good ideas happen. Mm-hmm. It's where, you know, if somebody asks me questions and I respond to them, I'm loving life right there, you know. And if I'm sitting here trying to laboriously put something together, it's like, I don't want to be doing this. I want to do something else. You know, so these two very different stories, but it's all in the same information.
It's all information, but coming from way two different places.
Yeah. Well, it's the same information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are things that I can look at where I'm talking about the same topic, and I brought it up in one case, and somebody else asked me about it in another case, and it's just this completely different life experience.
Mm-hmm. So even though you're giving the same information in both circumstances, there's a way different internal experience mm-hmm. you're having?
It's, you know, it's just divergent paths, sort of,
mm-hmm.
Experientially, which it's really, it, you know, it's fun to play with that, because well, it's something I've committed to working on for the year, essentially. I didn't realize that when I made that. I knew that that was something important, but I didn't actually have a handle on seeing how that process is working at the time. So it's kind of really come out for me.
So that commitment to give all of yourself, or?
Yeah, just give all that I have.
Give all that you have. That's a really important process for you.
Yeah. I think that's actually all I have on that.
Amy, I saw your hand.
I'm also looking at my best year yet plan. I was really successful for the first 3 months with this one commitment that I had to do this one thing monthly. And then April came, and and I got very busy. and there was this thing that that I wanted to do, that I had made a commitment to do each month. And I realized this past week that April was getting shorter, and then yesterday was the last day, and I had this plan to go home that night and do it. And I also had a plan to work on the email class assignments that I was behind on, and I ended up falling asleep and waking up and looking at the clock, and it said 2:10 a.m. May 1st. And it was so disappointing. Mm-hmm. To have missed the opportunity to have kept my commitment.
Mm-hmm. So just you two are looking at your best year yet plan, mm-hmm. and really seeing that there was a commitment you kept with that plan that mm-hmm. didn't get met, and you know, and how disappointing that is. Mm-hmm. And even though this person sounds like still had an intention mm-hmm. to meet that commitment right up to the last, you know, up to the line, and then, you know, just having fallen asleep and waking up and realizing that it's now the 1st of May and that commitment didn't get met.
Mm-hmm. And I'm still committed to do it, but what I'm seeing is that how just the importance of keeping commitments mm-hmm. because of that feeling of disappointment when mm-hmm. I don't.
So just that, again, it's reaffirming that importance of keeping a commitment.
Mm-hmm.
Because noticing that, it just sounds like there is someone inside that's like really disappointed mm-hmm. that commitment didn't get met, and not wanting to disappoint that person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. My intention for today is to look at what those commitments are that I have right now, that and really spending time to honor those today.
Mm. So it sounds like you're making an intention today to recommit
mm-hmm.
and honor those commitments today.
Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I am acknowledging, though, is that my that would be an area where in the past that would just be a reason to throw in the towel, mm-hmm. forget the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
and I'm not choosing mm-hmm. that option. I'm still committed to doing the thing it is that I wanted to mm-hmm. do in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's a day late, I'll do it twice in May. so the enthusiasm for the commitment has not mm-hmm. changed, even with the not meeting the deadline.
So that enthusiasm for the commitment hasn't changed, and you see that, you know, in the past, that sounds like just would have been a doorway for conditioning to walk right in and like, well, you know, just give it up.
Yeah.
And but you're able to see that now, and as you just said, you know, your enthusiasm hasn't waned, and you're going to continue on with the commitment, even though it doesn't maybe look like what you thought it was going to be originally, but maybe you'll do it twice in May.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Melinda.
Well, that was neat because it was reminding me, I think it was on the radio show during the discussion about commitment, that Sherry was talking with someone, and sort of the upshot was that I make a commitment and life happens.
Hmm.
And life gets in the way of my being able to do X. It doesn't mean, it's like not somehow really appreciating that I have a commitment,
mm-hmm.
even under, when there are circumstances that make it impossible, or if I lapse, or
mm-hmm.
whatever, so that the letter of the commitment isn't followed. It doesn't mean that the commitment has died.
Yeah.
I'm not using the language
yeah.
that she used, which I think said it so clearly.
Yeah.
It was a great relief to hear it,
mm-hmm.
because it kind of took the Nazi out of the commitment.
So it's just calling to mind something that you heard Sherry referring to on the radio show about
yeah.
commitment, and how, you know, it's hard to... As you say, it's, you know, hard to put into words, but it's like it's following the letter, or following the heart of the commitment, or that
yeah.
you know that there is a you can trust this person to keep her commitment, and it may not look like
yeah. I think maybe what just dropped in was it may have been with somebody who made a commitment not to yell at her kids anymore.
Uh-huh.
Could be
uh-huh.
making this up, but of course at some point she yelled at her kids. Which is not breaking the commitment, because the commitment is still there. Yeah, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It was so clear then. Because it's not to, for that, in that situation, not to allow the commitment sort of being breached
yeah.
to become a source of self-hate.
Exactly. It was what was just being referred to. It could so easily be an opportunity for
yeah.
conditioning.
Look,
self-hate.
Whatever you
yeah.
whatever you should
give
forget
up.
It.
Don't
you're
even,
a loser. We've
yeah.
done it all along.
Yeah.
And wanting to take away the commitment, wanting to take away what's underneath the commitment,
yeah.
the authenticity, the sincerity,
yeah.
The sort of good heart under
yeah.
the commitment.
Yeah.
So I yell at the kids. All right, well, we go back and we see how that happened, and we call on the mentor, and but we don't do any beatings.
Mm.
The beatings are what would really ruin the commitment.
What I'm seeing when you're sharing that is that, God, what a tool of conditioning that is to give up on the commitment, because eventually, well, who wants to make commitments? You know, I just give up on them. They lead to
yeah.
they lead to self-hate. They lead to misery.
And I know I'm a loser.
And
anyway,
I know I'm a loser
so
anyway. So for, you know, I'm not going to make a commitment. But coming from that other place
mm-hmm.
of I'm going to make a commitment, and no matter what it looks like, it's and I'm
yeah.
honor it. You know, then
yeah,
then you really want to.
Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah.
It just flashed through is one of the things they do in the AA that has always felt a little off to me is when somebody falls off the wagon, and what's suggested is if you fall off the wagon, you might as well give up, because that's the worst thing you can do.
Mm.
Instead of, wow, you know, how did that happen?
Mm.
And let's pull in more support.
Mm.
Let's whatever it takes, because underneath we know that you don't want to drink again or be drunk again or
mm-hmm.
yell at your kids or so how can I support you instead of where can I kick you next to let
yeah.
you know what a loser you are.
Yeah. Yeah, so you know, how can I support this person in keeping that commitment and looking at how that commitment didn't get met in the
mm-hmm.
you know, in the time frame.
Yeah, well, hey, how can we do it differently next time?
Do it differently.
So you know, or maybe you can yell in a whisper, or maybe you can...
And like you said, what kind of support, what extra support can I bring in to help with this commitment?
Yeah. Support your heart instead
support
of...
Support your heart.
The conditioning with the baseball bats.
Yeah. Thank you. Brian?
It's coming up for me around commitments is that the sort of the utility of the commitment is not the making the commitment and then fulfilling the commitment and then feeling good about it. It's the light that the existence of the commitment shines on the process of one's will being honored or being subverted.
So it's the process of, did you say making the commitment?
It just the fact that the commitment exists necessarily draws attention to what happens around whatever content it is to get the commitments around, and that brings that attention to the process by which the commitment either gets fulfilled or doesn't get fulfilled.
So it's making the commitment, and that gives you an opportunity to shine a light on the process around whether the commitment is kept or not kept, and that, I think you were saying, is really the value of a commitment.
Yeah, it really doesn't matter if the commitment actually ends up being met or not met, because that's still content. You know, that's kind of A or B, but the process that goes on that leads through that entire thing, regardless of how it comes out, it's a tremendous opportunity to see how does this work for me. You know, how is it that I see so clearly what is going to support me in my life and yet don't do it?
As you say that, it reminds me of making a change for good. That, you know, that's the essence of that, you know, just watching what happens around a commitment and how it gets kept or how it doesn't get kept.
It reminds me, one of my favorite topics is legalism in religion, because it's really funny, and you know, how people fixate on, okay, well, these are the rules, you know, and we got to follow these rules. And it's like, well, why? What's the point of the rules? These are the rules. You know, and so you get, my favorite example is if you ask the average Christian about God's commandments, they'll rattle off some list of 10 to some number. Some of the lists are actually in the Bible are actually longer than 10, and they don't actually add up, but they don't all match each other. But you go, almost nobody will say, you know, love your God and love your neighbor as yourself, which is all Jesus ever says when people ask him about that in the Gospels. You know, so it's like, well, what's the purpose of following a bunch of commandments? Well, it's to put you in a state where you can love your God and love your neighbor as yourself. But putting the structure ahead of the spirit, which is kind of just, you know, that's that in the Gospels it's called the leaven of the Pharisees. And the disciples never actually understand what Jesus is talking about. He says, beware the leaven of the Pharisees. And they're like, oh, crap, we forgot the bread. He's like, no, I'm not talking about the bread. Didn't you see me feed the 4,000 people with the one loaf of bread? The bread is under control. But this process is going to get in and take away from you what I'm trying to teach you.
So that is... demonstrating the same sort of thing that you were referring to, just like getting carried away with looking at, well, did I keep the commitment, didn't I keep the commitment, instead of like looking at, you know, what was it behind the commitment, or the process and the process around the commitment.
From what did this arise? That's what we want to see. There's this place now and then where I can see really clearly, and it's all right there, and then something comes in and takes that away, and so I want to see all of that process. So how does the arising happen? How does the taking away happen? How does all this happen? So I make the commitment, and what the commitment does is puts, you know, it's on my calendar. So it just keeps pulling my attention back to, I saw this once clearly. What is for my life now? what's happening that's taking that away from me? And then, you know, we do it over and over and over and over again, and we get to see all kinds of neat little things, like when it comes in after we fail to meet the commitment, they say, oh, well, actually, you should just give up. I'm like, okay, that's interesting. Because I saw clearly enough once to see what was for my life, and saw clearly enough to make a commitment, and now you're trying to take both of those away from me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so just, it's all just a kind of an opportunity to see. And that leaving of the Pharisee, that little tiny, you know, thing that just grows and grows and grows and grows until it takes over everything.
So that opportunity to see what was present in the making of the commitment, rather than being caught up in, I'm going to be a better person if I make this, you know, this is going to lead me to being a better person if I can fulfill this commitment. Sounds like that little distinction there with the, I forget what it's called, the
leaving of the Pharisees.
The leaving of the Pharisees. Yeah,
the leaving is an archaic word for yeast, basically.
So it's basically like okay, the right.
Exactly. You put this little bit in, and completely changes everything. All structure of the thing is completely changed.
Thank you. June,
I talked about making and keeping commitments to myself in this room ad nauseam 2 or 3 weeks ago, and you know, I know how not to keep them. I have looked at how I don't keep them. And egocentric karmic conditioning / self-hate has made sure that I could see that very clearly.
Has made sure that you could see how you don't keep them?
Yeah. So I've been keeping one. I was talking about losing weight, and I've been keeping that commitment. And what I've done is, I've enlisted help.
So you've enlisted help to keep this commitment.
Yeah. And I would never have thought that was the answer. Or part of the answer.
So you would never thought that unless you help was part of the answer to keeping a commitment.
Yeah. It's kind of, again, that 12-step thing about turn it over. I'm actually on a diet. They have commercials on everywhere all the time. They send you the food that you are to eat. It's out of my hand. It's out of egocentric karmic conditioning / self-hate catches hands.
It sounds like very much like the monastery. As a schedule, it's out of our hands. This has taken it out of your hands, out of ego's hands.
That is a very good point. I hadn't seen it that way. Yes. And so, of course, there was a voice saying, you're not doing anything. You're not learning anything. You're not growing. You're not developing as a spiritual being, as a good Zen student. God is turning it all over to somebody else.
Sounds like the same voice that accompanies you putting.
Thank you, okay, I'll quit because it's not... I'm not being the person I should be, so I'll quit. That's what you're angling for, isn't it?
So it's angling for you to just quit because you're not being the person that you should be.
And there's more. when I started, I was sick with all this allergy stuff and wasn't exercising. And it was quite a bit easy. It was actually easy to stay within the confines of the program. In that case, I've been feeling better, exercising more, and I get hungrier. And the campaign to just chocolate diet when I get really hungry, which you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to let yourself get really hungry, but I tend to anyway. I tend to get talked out of eating when I should anyway. I think that's the better way to say that. And I forget how I started the sentence, but it's been less it's getting more complex. And I've actually fallen into the not keeping commitment trap once. Did it kind of eyes wide open, I think, because I was tired of being hungry. And but the truth is, that's the only time, isn't it? But of course, the voice wants to make a big deal out of that.
The voice probably wants to focus on that one time that that, and just watching how the, it was a little bit easier in the beginning when you had allergies and you weren't exercising, and now as time goes on and you're feeling better, and you know you get hungrier, and then it wants to. It sounds like it's talking you out of eating when you're feeling a little hungry and.
Yeah, it'll talk me out of eating. It'll talk me out of eating enough.
Eating enough.
Because you're really not supposed to get hungry. It's a restricted calorie diet. It operates on calories in, calories out, which is so simple. I don't have pseudoxanthus to have to take that over and make something of it. Calories in, calories out. Burn away and you take and you lose weight. There's just no wiggle room for pseudos in there. And that's, I could rattle on about that forever, but I am really not wanting to. Oh, 3 weeks. It's been out of my hands. I've lost weight. It just flies in the face of everything the voices were telling me to begin with. It's just they're just kind of sitting stunned in the corner. And that's where I like them. That's a good spot.
Let's keep the voices stunned in the corner. Diet. Just really seeing that after 3 weeks that, you know, you've lost weight and it hasn't been anything like what the voices told you would be at the beginning of this commitment.
Yeah, and I haven't thought that it is very much the same process as practicing presence instead of having. Practicing presence instead of dieting. Turning it over.
So just seeing that it's very much the same thing, practicing presence instead of the content of whatever it may be and turning it over.
Oh, I just thought a little bit more about commitment. It seems as though when we make commitments that really from the heart, that the commitment is being true to myself. And so if I yell at the kids, that doesn't mean I'm not being true to myself. Something, I was just seeing a little bit more about how breaking a commitment, maybe it would be neat to think of different language for the lapses, because the commitment isn't broken. There's simply been a lapse. and the wish to be true to myself and the understanding that doing that thing that I've said I'm going to do, whether it's, whatever it is, that I, the commitment that I made from my heart, that it's still there. It's not even damaged by a lapse. Mm-hmm. And to not let, because what conditioning will do is make the lapse an infraction somehow. Mm-hmm. And it's like, where I saw it was in that example of the leavening of the Pharisees. that authentic nature, true nature, being true to self, is the thread and continues to be observed and held, even, or maybe especially when there's some kind of lapse. Mm-hmm. And that's, for me, that place of not getting a beating for it, but just getting more coaching.
So that place of a commitment that comes from the heart or true nature is kind of like the underlying or thread that runs through that commitment, and the lapse doesn't affect that at all.
Right. Yeah, I can kind of see how that feels like that's what Sherry was talking about mm-hmm. in part of that mm-hmm. radio show. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, the lapse, it could be an opportunity to just bring us back to that original commitment that came from the heart.
Yeah, and to get support when we need it.
And to get support, rather than being a time to focus on the lapse. And,
right, exactly. Yeah. Maybe it's the simple as the commitment is the process, the lapse is just some content. Yeah. I don't know.
Brian.
Kind of the spirit of volunteering things that aren't complete. I'd share a little bit of what I've been poking around recently. What I've been looking at recently is the creation of perceptions. And it almost begins to feel like kind of the objectification of life. So it's this process of just making stuff up as far as I can tell. When I'm really paying attention, it feels like I'm living in a world populated by really complex Mr. Potato Heads.
Complex Mr. Potato Heads.
Yeah. So, I mean, not complex in that they have some form. You know, they're just this formless blob on which to stick stuff.
Ah, I see what you, okay.
And it's like I live in a world of a million Mr. Potato Heads, and I have like 2 to 3 sets of accessories. You know, so it's like I'm cruising along, and here's a Mr. Potato Head, and I can see, okay, it's wearing these glasses, but there's still like 10 other slots to fill in here, so I just go to my box, and I've only got, you know, these 10 things, so I just start filling everything in. Right, so there's one little tiny piece of information about this Mr. Potato Head that corresponds to anything that exists out there. It came with the glasses. All right, but I put the mustache on. It's the same mustache I put everywhere. And I put on the hat and the shoes and the arms and the, you know. And so I'm making it up, and I keep seeing the same Mr. Potato Head everywhere. And it's like, wait a minute. I've seen those shoes before. You know, it really kind of throws into sharp relief how much has to happen for me to experience the world as I think it is. There's a lot of work that goes into it.
A lot of work that goes into shaping the perception of how the world is and how you expect it to be. Is that?
Well, I'm not sure how expectation gets into it yet. That's another unfinished area. But, like, for example, I was sitting in my hermitage, and I'm sitting and looking down this way, and there's like a shelf up here. And I've set just some miscellaneous objects on there. I have no idea what's up there. But I got some clear information that something was up there because I could hear ticking. And I watched my brain go, okay, what's ticking? What's all the things? All the things in our life, what do we have? I'm like, oh, okay, well, there's this watch that I have that I could have set the watch up there. So it's probably this watch. And then, bang, there's the watch. And so I'm looking over here. It's out of my, you know, my field of vision, like, ends right here. But there's a watch sitting right here, and I can see it. It's crystal clear. It's perfect. I can see all the little links, and I can see the sunlight coming in and hitting it, and I can see the little dial going like this with every click.
So the ticking, suddenly there's a full-blown picture of the watch in minute detail.
Yeah, I know how it feels. I know if I pull on the band, how that resistance is going to feel. I know, you know, the tactile, the everything but smell, because I've never actually smelled that watch. but it's all there, right? And then I started really kind of cruising around my sensory experience, and, you know, there's airplanes flying overhead, and I know what they look like. Uh-huh. And I know, you know, I know just like things like they're not flipping over as they're cruising along, right? They're going in a nice, straight, sensible line, and they're maintaining their orientation, because otherwise people inside would not be having a good time. And so I sat there for a little while with that, and what I decided to do was just to start mess with stuff, just messing with stuff. So I just, you know, the only information that I have really, truly, is that I perceive the sounds of ticking going on. And so I just decided, instead of going to memory and pulling out this I'm just going to make one up. So I just made up a little grandfather clock sitting there, just a little tiny miniature grandfather clock, like some brass trim, and, like, you know, it has semi-transparent face so you can see the internal mechanisms, and a little pendulum going along, and the little pendulum had a little assist thing coming from some little power supply, because I know it'll wind down eventually otherwise. And I just sat there with that, and I just sat there and maintained that perception of an object until it did whatever it did it needed to do to be consistent, and then I just sat there the rest of the time with a grandfather clock. And then I got up and went about my day, and I realized, like, 6 hours later, I thought back to that, and there was a grandfather clock sitting there. Now that's a memory, because I never looked to see what was there.
So you played with this perception and just taking as the basis a ticking sound, and went from the watch to a grandfather clock, and seeing that in minute detail, it sounds like. And then later on, having this memory of the grandfather clock arise, and it was as real, it sounds like that was as real as a memory of the watch sitting there on your shelf.
And for all I know, that grandfather clock is sitting down there ticking away as we speak in my hermitage. It's like one day, ages ago, I can't even remember, I was sitting in a chair, and this memory arose. Well, I was really thirsty sitting in the chair, and this memory arose that I had gotten a glass of water and set it down next to this chair, like, way earlier in the day, and forgotten about it. And I was sitting there, and I was like, wait, did I just make that up because I really want a glass of water to be there? Or did that really happen? And, you know, sat there with that for a while, kind of puzzling over that, and peeked over and, like, sure enough, there's a glass of water, okay. And I was blown away at the correspondence between my memory and the world, because it didn't, for a moment there, it just didn't seem certain. And, you know, trying to explain that to people, they look at you like you're a little nuts. It's that same, you know, this process of going to memory to construct what the world looks like, and it's really schematic. Like, I have tons of memories that are third person, right? So I can remember myself being in a room and what was happening in the room and what was going on in the room. And I've never had the experience of being in the third person. So somewhere that got made up. It almost seems like an analog to, like, the voice that says you.
That being able to perceive yourself in the third person is
not necessarily that it's the same process, but it's kind of a hint that something's going on there that ought to be looked at. Like, wait a minute, how can I ever have a memory of, like, my shoulder, and I'm not looking in a mirror or something like that, you know? But I've got plenty. And I just watch, you know? My brain is happily constructing, you know? Somebody, I had a friend, college, I went through this period where I was just a complete insomniac. And had early morning classes because I was in, just doing a math degree, and, you know, this class is only offered once every 2 years, and the professor says it's at 8:30. You're going to class at 8:30, and so I was just completely out of my head. And I had a friend talking about, you know, this time she came over to my house and we were hanging out, and I'm like, it never happened. I've never been to my house. It's like, yeah, you know, you have this cat, and you have the bookshelves over here, and you know, she's describing the inside of my house, so I'm pretty sure she's been there at that point. But it was, there was nothing.
No memory that could.
But then, that so upset me that my mind started making memories to fill that in, to fill in that gap. So now I can actually remember her being there. But I'm pretty sure that those, if I could go back in time, actually wouldn't correspond to what reality looked like at that time and place.
So there was no memory that you could recall that just fritzed somebody so much upset that you saw memories being constructed and put into that blank place. Mm-hmm. But you still question whether or not if you went back in that time, those memories actually relate to that experience or not.
Yeah. And of course, I've long since had a skepticism about my memory because I heard about this study where they brought in people and talked to them about their memories of going to Disneyland as children, and something like a third to 40% or something like that could just through leading questioning could be convinced to remember hugging Bugs Bunny at Disneyland, which. Bugs Bunny's, you know, Warner Brothers character is never at Disneyland. Right? But this huge segment of people were convinced that as a child they hugged Bugs Bunny at Disneyland. You know, it's just so, the mind is just so willing to build a coherent picture rather than accepting that it doesn't have enough data to operate on. You know, I don't actually remember that, so it's like, no, actually I want a picture that coheres with all the information that I'm getting in, so I'm just going to make up the details.
So the mind just makes up the details to cohere.
And that's, you know, that's the Mr. Potato Head. It's a feeling that there's nothing really out there. Mm-hmm. It's kind just...
Of, feels like it's going back to what originally, you know, being meaning-making machines. Mm-hmm. You know, just how grasping all the time to make meaning out of whatever is arising in the moment there in front of us.
Yeah, it's a little challenging because it's like I want to turn my attention to life, but what am I looking at? You know, and it's just this extra another layer of, well, what I'm actually looking at is myself again. Mm-hmm. Myself. And that's a long tangent. So, and, you know, in the spirit of living up to my commitment, I'm going to leave it completely incomplete there.
Thank you. I have a couple more minutes if someone has something they'd like to look at.
I'd echo that. So the neat thing about my Mr. Potato Head experience is that it keeps driving away any perception of kind of what am I, like an answer to that question. You know, so start, coming in, he's like, what am I? And I have a pretty firm belief about what I am. You know, I do these things, and I think these things, and I hold these opinions, and I think this is right and this is wrong. And then that kind of, you know, practicing sort of undermines quite a lot of that. And, you know, get to see that there's so much of it that's really just this conditioned belief, and you know, I'm identifying with these voices and that those voices and whatnot, but still there's something there, right? It's not just a series of a continual series of identification. And so then I start having this, you know, sort of paying attention to how perceptions get created, and it starts to become, you know, there's a line in the Diamond Sutra that says well, it's the Buddha's talking about the vow to save all beings, but you can't be attached to having saved any beings. And he says, why not? Well, Subhuti, a bodhisattva who creates the perception of a being cannot be called a bodhisattva. And why not? Because no one can be called a bodhisattva who creates the perception of self, or creates the perception of a being, a life, or a soul. Which is really what got me on this whole thing in the first place. I mean, what the heck does that mean? And just seeing that, you know, I'm just as much a Mr. Potato Head as anybody else is, or any object is, or anything. You know, there's all of these, this very, very minimal sensory information that comes in, some content and some things that have been conditioned in there, but there's a huge amount of construction that goes into making a life, making a self, making a being. In that same way, there's all of this work, and it's, you know, filling in with this limited box of tools, and then you really go, well, okay, I can see that, you know, this life, this self, all of this business, maybe I'm making all that up. But what is the thing that creates perceptions? What's that? Which I have no idea about. That came to me a couple of days ago. Okay, well, maybe over here this will be fruitful to look at.
So what is that thing that creates perceptions? And that's going back into, it sounds like, looking at what am I? Mm-hmm. You know, seeing yourself. The discussion started with identified as this being that creates perceptions out of this Mr. Potato Head box that he carries around, but then, you know, who is this?
Yeah.
Who is this that's creating the perceptions?
And it's like anything to attach to as some sort of ground of subjectivity is just retreats ahead constantly. It's like one step ahead of whatever the ability to see. So when I can see, when I start to see my identification with my conditioned beliefs, then I can see that, okay, so that's not me, so me is somewhere. Okay, it's probably just right over here, though, so I'll just get in there and let me just, okay, done with this for a moment, let me actually go look over. Well, no, now it's out here. This is, and it's just fascinating. And you know, of course, assurance coming out of the sutras is that process never ends.
Exactly, as you're describing that, it's, you know, very clear to see. It just is like continually, like it's kind of like it's always putting the attention out there to something outside of yourself, or you know.
Well, it's just, you know, it's like it's an old story of a scientist, and who the scientist is actually changes depending upon who's telling the story, giving a lecture about the Earth and the structure of the Earth and the structure of the solar system and all of that. And at the end of the lecture, this woman stands up and says, "You can't fool me. I know the truth. The Earth is flat and it sits on the back of an elephant."
And it sits on the back of what?
And it sits on the back of an elephant.
Oh, an elephant.
Just hurtling through space, which is a fun picture. So the scientist thinks, "Oh, well, I've got her. Okay, madam, if the Earth is sitting on the back of an elephant, what's the elephant sitting on?" She says, sitting on the back of a turtle. Oh, well, what's the turtle sitting on? Oh, you can't fool me, it's turtles all the way down. And that's kind of what it feels like, you know, grasping for something to... What is the foundation of this? And it's just turtles all the way down. So, it's very incomplete, but... So it goes.
Thank you. I think that's our time this morning. Thank you.